Hey folks, Lee here up at the top just for a little intro to thank you for your patience while we worked on getting this episode out to you. I recorded this back in March with my guest host Frankie, and it was a really wonderful conversation, had a lot of fun talking about this topic as well as researching it, and I'm very excited to finally bring it to you. I just recently moved house, so that's been part of the delay. I also want to thank Avery Severs, who edited this episode for me while a bunch of other things were going on. I hope that you enjoy, and I look forward to chatting with you all in our next fun thing to come. Hello, and welcome to History is Gay, a podcast that examines the underappreciated and overlooked queer ladies, gents, and gentle envies that have always been there in the unexplored corners of history, because history has never been as straight as you think. This is Lee Pfeffer, your host of History is Gay, in your podcast feeds with a new wonderful episode that honestly I've been like planning to do since we started this show back in 2018. Oh god, I've been doing this for a while now. I am joined by a wonderful guest host that I think I messaged them back in 2018 when I read an article of theirs, and now we have finally both gotten our stuff together to bring you a wonderful episode all about the queer history of women's baseball and softball, and particularly the queer history of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, since my brain has gone completely into a League of Their Own brain rot. So I'm very excited to bring to the podcast Frankie de la Creta. They are a sports journalist and writer. They have a wonderful book about the history of women playing football in the 70s, and is basically the reason why I'm doing this episode at all, because they brought me into the wonderful queer world of A League of Their Own. Hi, Frankie. How are you?
Hi, Lee. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. I think I reached out to you on Twitter. 2018, you wrote an article for Narratively about the queer history behind A League of Their Own, and you basically went into a whole bunch of research and interviews that you had done about queer players in the real-life All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. I think it was at that time that I was like, I want to do an episode on this. I think I have in our like brainstorm document, like reach out to this person to do this episode. And then many years passed by. And then the new Amazon show came out and it was like, it's time. Let's do it. So I'm so happy that you said yes after like 3 years of me procrastinating.
Yes. And the show has had people finding my article, which has been really nice. The showrunners have actually cited this article that we're going to talk about a lot as research and inspiration for the series. So it's definitely relevant.
Hell yes. Yeah, I mean, could you tell those who are listening just a little bit about you, what you do, where you are, how you got into this work, and what makes you tick? What makes you want to write about sports and queerness?
Yeah, I'm a freelance journalist, and my beat mostly sits at the intersection of sports and gender and queerness. I write about this because I'm a huge sports fan, and I'm a huge history nerd, and I felt like I wasn't seeing sports writing that reflected what I wanted to read. And it's, I think, one of those situations where you have to make the art or create the content that you want to be consuming. And so that is really how I ended up doing this. But I'm also the co-author of a book called Hail Mary, The Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League. And that is basically A League of Their Own, but football and openly gay and racially integrated in the 70s. It's about the National Women's Football League, which is the first professional women's football league in U.S. history.
Yeah, so stay tuned for episode two with Frankie, because we're definitely going to need to talk about that. Also, just like the beautiful image of buff ladies and padding and all that gear. I'm a homosexual. It's great. So that's what we're talking about today. We are talking about the queer history of women playing baseball and softball, going a little bit outside of the league to talk about, you know, some other folks, but we'll be primarily talking about this All-American Girls Professional Baseball League and why certain things were created and established the way they were in terms of like how we remember the league, as some people have called it a lipstick league, and how that intersects with femininity and performative heterosexuality and all that fun stuff. Content warnings for this episode will include, obviously, period-typical homophobia, racism, as well as, I think, a brief mention of some violence near the end when we talk about one of the players. But otherwise, this should be a pretty tame episode. But as usual, we will put in our show notes, any content warnings, time signatures, so you can avoid any of them that you may need to. Format for this episode, it's going to be a mix. We're going to talk about the various leagues and the history of queerness and women in softball and baseball, and we'll talk about some individual players. And as usual, we will end the podcast with how gay were they, our personal ranking about how likely it is that they weren't straight. So let's get into it. We're going to start with some historical context of the time, the first professional women's baseball leagues, which were softball and or softball combination of baseball. We'll talk about that in a second. Lands us in the middle of slash nearing the end of World War II. What's important to know about that is that during this time, societal expectations in the US and roles for men and women were shifting immensely. Women and people of color found more opportunities for employment and access than they had had before. You have these, you know, images of Rosie the Riveter and women going to work to make up for the deficits of the men in the, you know, who had gone into the service. By the 1940s, a lot of women were wearing pants kind of as casual wear, and it stuck around more so than it did back in like World War I, which was kind of the first time we really saw that as a trend. And it was inspired in part by a lot of the marketing and imagery around women going to work. Queer people at this time had begun forging communities and places of gathering, so you had the proliferation of queer bars really popping up, and even the military provided opportunities for queer people to find each other that weren't available in other ways before. Even the Army Special Services branch would set up shows for GI entertainment, which included drag shows, female impersonation. Fun fact, one of the most popular of these shows was called This is the Army, and it was even performed for President FDR at the White House. So tell me again that drag is a threat. If the President of the United States in the 1940s was like, hell yeah, I want to watch this, tell me drag is a threat again. I dare you. World War II also opened up the military establishment to women with the Women's Army Corps, which for many was their first kind of opportunity to be independent and work in areas that were previously barred to them. And for some women, especially a lot of queer women, it gave them the opportunity to dress more masculinely than they would kind of domestically, and the opportunity to live outside societal expectations. However, as we know from some of our other previous episodes, post-war, a lot of that just goes whoop, bye-bye, as the end of the war comes in and there's a whole bunch of conservatism and backlash that just explodes, and we get the Lavender Scare, which we talked about in our episode on the homophile movement. Butch and femme dynamics were really important, and bar culture actually contributed to this a lot in the lesbian community. Gay and lesbian bars first emerged in like some form or another in the 1880s. Speakeasies during and following Prohibition were really common places for gathering. We've talked about that in separate episodes, you know, where we talked about the Harlem Renaissance and a lot of these places that were flourishing because speakeasies were already kind of taboo, so the queer element wasn't as much of a danger. By the 1940s, lesbian bars and gay bars were vital spaces for queer people, and lesbian bars were a crucial factor in developing this butch femme dynamic and culture. Basically, a style of dress and a code of conduct, and really emphasized butches defending femmes and the bars that they, you know, all gathered in and shared. So keep that in mind as we're talking about the ways that people are interacting at this time. Frankie, do you want to give us a little dive into the history of how softball came up and then how women got involved in playing ball?
Yeah, so softball originated in Chicago in 1887. And it was a way for people to play baseball indoors in the winter, which is why it has a larger, softer ball, smaller bat. It's why the playing field is smaller than we see in baseball. And the game is much more fast-paced because of that smaller playing field. It took off in popularity. It wasn't long before women's teams were being organized. Women have been playing it from the beginning. It was equally popular among men and women. Leagues were formed all over the Midwest and the rest of the country. The first known women's baseball team played at Vassar College in 1866. They were called the Resolutes. They played in ankle-length dresses with these incredible belts. I have a picture of them in my living room.
Oh my God. We're going to have to share that on our blog post.
Women had to play baseball in Victorian dress at that time, ankle-length skirts. And so there were these loosely organized touring teams of what were known as Bloomer Girls by the mid-1880s. Sometimes they played against and with men. Some of the men played in drag. This was regarded as kind of a novelty, kind of a form of entertainment. It wasn't really taken that seriously.
Yeah, you had like kind of sleazy sports promoters and, you know, questionable characters. And, you know, some of the men who were playing in drag would have like 2 days old stubble, right? So everybody was in on the like kind of quote unquote joke.
Yes, it's very much in theme with women's sports being seen as kind of a joke or a gimmick. And for the entertainment of men, we see this here too. Women's softball started out as slow pitch because of sexism. People thought that fast pitch would break a woman's bones.
It's fragile.
Again, we see this a lot in the history of women's sports, that if they got like hit in the breast, it would cause breast cancer, that their uterus would fall out from running too fast.
I'm just imagining a baseball hitting someone's chest and just like exploding, just titty explosion.
Yeah. So slow pitch, it did eventually evolve to fast pitch, and the players were on par with professional baseball players at the time. By the 1920s and 30s, we saw hundreds of women and men playing in softball and recreational tournaments and leagues. It was especially popular in Chicago, in the Midwest, in California, and Arizona. And by 1943, there were at least 40,000 women's softball teams. And most of these women's softball teams wore shorts or pants. They were like modified versions of men's uniforms, which you actually see in the beginning of A League of Their Own when all of the women show up to the big tryout at Wrigley Field. They are not wearing skirts. They are wearing mostly pants and shorts.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of like just from pictures that I've seen, some of them are even, you know, if they wanted to lean in a little bit to the glamour of girls playing softball, they were wearing pants or shorts, but it was like these like satiny kind of outfits. So you still had a little bit of that glitz and glamour, but you know, you didn't have to wear a 6-inch skirt.
They were shiny.
They were shiny. So let's kind of transition into talking about the league that everybody knows, that everybody's familiar with from the various iterations of A League of Their Own, which is the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, which is a mouthful. We probably at some point will just shorten it through this episode to All-American, or The League. So, it was started by Philip K. Wrigley, the dude who started the chewing gum company, and he was also at the time the owner of the Chicago Cubs. Basically, thousands of minor league and over 500 major league baseball players had been drafted for World War II, and so Wrigley saw the opportunity to keep baseball going. He was like, well, people aren't going to be as interested in the minor leagues that haven't been as crazy decimated all over as people who are tuning into this very small pool of MLB. So why not, you know, try the novelty of women playing baseball? And he wanted to keep people in stadiums. The league lasted from 1943 to 1954. So it has a 12-year run. And it started out with four teams made of 60 players total. So you have the original teams were the Racine Belles, the Rockford Peaches, Kenosha Comets, and South Bend Blue Sox. And this was all centered around the Midwest. All of the initial tryouts were held at Wrigley Field in Chicago. You'll note that there are no actual, the first couple of years of the league, there's no teams in Chicago proper, and we'll talk about that later why. But by its end in 1954, it had expanded to 10 teams and I think nearly like 600 players. And there were a lot of teams that like moved around. Some only lasted one season or 1 year, or they moved to a different city, etc. There's the Milwaukee Chicks, who then became the Grand Rapids Chicks, Minneapolis Minarets, who were only around for a season, Fort Wayne Daisies, Muskegon Lassies, Peoria Red Wings, Chicago Colleens and Springfield Sallies, both only in 1948, Kalamazoo Lassies, and the Battle Creek Bells, who then moved to Muskegon. They were just going all over. This entire league was just full of tweaking, like, all the time.
So, yeah, and I mean, this is actually, I think people don't realize when you see all of these teams kind of pop up and fold that it seems like it's a lot of failure, but this is actually very, very typical in the beginning of sports leagues, men's leagues too. Like 90% of NFL teams that started in the first 10 years of the league folded. So this is a very, very common experience.
If you want to know like the nitty gritty of like the league and the teams and how everything was created and why certain teams were in certain cities and then had to move to others, etc., one of the books that we used as, you know, a source for this episode is Girls of Summer by Lois Brown. It's a really great just kind of timeline and detail with interviews from players, and that'll give you all the juicy details. Another thing that I think is really interesting is that it's called the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, but it started out and also was never like fully just baseball by the end even, but it started out as underhand pitch softball with like tweaks. The league and game rules would change constantly throughout its tenure. They basically created like a unique mix of softball and baseball, and they changed rules annually, sometimes even mid-season, basically just like edging closer and closer to baseball as they went on. They changed to sidearm pitching and then overhand pitching by the end of the league, which actually ended up burning out a lot of their longtime players. They were like, I didn't sign up to pitch like this and destroy my body in this way. I'm out. I mean, there's a reason why you just blow through pitchers. It's because your arm and your elbow can only take that much of that. So by the second year of the league, Wrigley, the founder, wasn't all that concerned with the future of Major League Baseball now that the tides were turning in the war, and he basically lost interest and he sold the league to his business partner Arthur Meyerhoff, who ran it pretty much through its end in 1954. The peak of the league was 1948. It drew, I think, like a million people or close to a million people. And it was at that point that the success kind of declined until its end in 1954. Still successful, but it never quite reached that level of attendance and interest. 11 players from the league were eventually inducted into the National Women's Baseball Hall of Fame, and in 1988, a permanent exhibit on women's baseball opened at the National Baseball Hall of Fame. So that's kind of, you know, that's some of the legacy that we have here.
The look, rules, and organization of this league really emphasized cis heteronormative femininity and beauty, wholesomeness, and this was a means to capitalize on women athletes, but also prevent them from being assumed to be mannish lesbian ball players, which, as we'll see, many of them were.
Yeah. Surprise! There's lesbians here.
Scholar Barbara Gregorich writes that players had to counterbalance their participation in a, quote, masculine endeavor by intensifying the kind of deportment that society considered feminine. Because many of the best baseball players were lesbians, it was impossible for the league to exclude them. But they put policies in place explicitly in order to avoid the public perception of them being gay, and to differentiate them from these like rough and masculine perceived softball teams. In 1943, a magazine article warned that the league would turn women's baseball into a, quote, uncouth Amazon spectacle.
I'd pay to see that, honestly.
In a letter to financial backers, when he was pitching the league, Wrigley said that they would select the kind of players that people will want to see in action. Then we will groom them to make sure they're acceptable. It won't be like the bad old days of peep shows and bloomer girls.
Yeah, so that really gives you an idea of like how people were viewing these like touring softball teams that were around. Like they're putting peep shows and bloomer girls in the same sentence.
And they're really worried that people won't come see these players if they are, you know, mannish or unattractive to men. Time magazine reported that when they were recruiting players for the league, scouts explicitly turned down several really great players because they were either too uncouth, too hard-boiled, or too masculine.
Yeah, Max Carey, one of the original managers of the league, who became the eventual president, specifically emphasized that, quote, "femininity is the keynote of our league. No pants-wearing, tough-talking female softballer will play on any of our four teams." Spoiler alert.
Yeah, and I mean, there are headlines, right? Like, tomboy tactics out of bounds in All-American Softball League. They wanted players to play like a man and look like a lady. One player said they wanted them to look like Betty Grable and play like Joe DiMaggio.
Those two couldn't be more far removed.
Yes.
One of the primary ways, other than, like, marketing, that they emphasized this image of the league was through their incredibly extensive rules and code of conduct. We'll link it in our sources, but it's very thorough. Each team was to be monitored by female chaperones. So you'll see them in pictures in, you know, if you've seen the movie or the TV show, you know, they're usually in like somewhat like military-ish lady outfits. And these chaperones approved all outings and dates and living arrangements. Unlike the show, you know, most of the players didn't like all live in a cool boarding house together. It was like they were put up by sponsored families and, you know, in hotels in different places. Players weren't even allowed to drive their own cars past city limits without special permission. So, I mean, they really were, like, locking these women down. They were under, like, really strict curfews, which is why you see in fictional depictions, but also in, like, all of these wonderful oral history interviews, all these great stories of anywhere from, like, 15 to, like, in their 20s, women playing pranks on these poor chaperones and, like, sneaking out late at night to go do stuff.
Yeah, these are adult women who are being treated like, I mean, teenagers, really.
They weren't allowed to smoke or drink in public places, and it was, like, no hard liquor at all. And they specifically were like, no cursing! And I put in the outline, like, SpongeBob meme, talk like a lady, you know, is what that makes me think of, like, women don't curse or use slang. Literally in the beauty guide that they get, there's literally an entire section about, like, not using casual language or slang because it's unladylike.
Everything is unladylike.
I'm not interested in being a lady, ever. Players were actually required to attend charm school courses, so that is straight up absolutely true. They hired Helena Goldstein and her Gold Coast Salon to do these charm school lessons. And sometimes they would have to do it just like after being in the field and practicing for like 10 hours. They'd have to go do these things and learn about makeup and posture, etiquette. Players who didn't agree to do this charm school were cut before the end of spring training. It was a, hey, you're doing it this way or no go. Some players in oral history interviews have kind of insisted that the charm school classes helped them survive in a new social class. But, you know, many of these players were so hungry to play that, as Sue Kidd, one of the players, put it, they would have done most anything that wasn't sinful just for the opportunity to play ball. I can't remember which player it was who said that she'd rather play ball than eat.
The players really were willing to do pretty much anything, right? They even had to play in these uncomfortable dresses, and they were like one-piece uniforms that had a skirt on the bottom, and the rules of conduct said that the uniform skirts shall not be shorter than 6 inches above the kneecap. And if you think about this, players are sliding. They're still expected to play baseball, to slide, you know, to dive for balls. And so they are constantly injuring themselves, scraping their thighs and like butts raw. They have these massive bruises from doing this. And I think a lot about the Lingerie Football League when we talk about this, because women are so desperate to be able to play the sports that they want to play that they are willing to do this. They're willing to play in a skirt or go to charm school or play in their underwear, right? Just to get a chance.
They called them strawberries, right? I was watching a video and I think Maybelle Blair said that she still has like a chunk out of her rear end from sliding. She's like in her 90s.
Yes, these permanent injuries. In the film A League of Their Own, there's that scene where the player is like on the bench with that big bruise. That was a real bruise that she got during one of the sliding scenes. That is not makeup. So you can imagine that this is what these players' legs looked like just literally all the time. the rules about the feminine dress code extended off the field as well. They had to always be wearing feminine attire, even when they were not actively engaged in practice or playing ball. The code of conduct said at no time may a player appear in the stands in her uniform or wear slacks or shorts in public. One of the players, one of the original Rockford Peaches named Lil Jackson, actually said that even at hotels when they were touring for games, if you were wearing slacks, you had to use the servant's elevator. You couldn't use the main elevator. You basically had to go in the back.
They also forbid masculine, quote unquote, haircuts. So there's a line in the code of conduct that says boyish bobs are not permissible. And in general, your hair should be well groomed at all times, with longer hair preferable to short haircuts. Lipstick should always be on. Players were also not allowed to hang out with members of other teams. They had a very strict anti-fraternization policy. And supposedly, in the code of conduct, it was for upholding rivalry. We'll talk about it later, but the actual line in the code of conduct says, in order to sustain the complete spirit of rivalry between clubs, that members of different clubs must not fraternize at any time during the season.
Yeah. It's really easy for us to chalk a lot of this up to like being of the time, right? But I think people do not realize how intentional all of this was. It was intentionally homophobic. It existed to prevent these women from being seen as lesbians. And so, yes, some of it can be chalked up to that, but really it existed for this specific reason.
And not only was it homophobic, it was also deeply racist and deeply classist. So Wrigley's wife, Helen Blanche Atwater Wrigley, was actually somebody who played a large part in shaping this image of the women in the league. There's an article that we read that has a really wonderful quote that says, for a population emerging from the Depression with sponsors barely eking out an existence, any women's team with uniquely designed uniforms, salaries, and travel and food allowances would be considered classy by comparison. So really kind of trying to differentiate themselves from those, you know, more working class softball leagues that were happening. And of course, the league was only white women. There were some Cuban players in later years of the league, but the league never integrated, even once the major leagues integrated. I believe Jackie Robinson started, I think his first season was 1947 in the major leagues, right? Basically, the rules and standards for femininity and beauty in this code of conduct really very specifically upheld white middle-class standards of beauty that colluded very deliberately against Black players who wouldn't have been deemed a quote-unquote fit for the league anyway. So even though they never had in their, like, official, you know, rules or anywhere written down, like, no Black players, just the rules of the standards of femininity upholding, like, white supremacy barred many of the Black women who wanted to try out for this just by virtue of that. So that's also really important to think about here. So, why are we talking about this? Why do we think women ballplayers are gay? Why is this league so terrified of people thinking that these women will be gay? We're all familiar with this stereotype of female athletes, especially softball players, being lesbians. But where does this stereotype come from, right? How intertwined are these worlds of sport and queer women? That's what we're going to be talking about a big, big chunk.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It is a stereotype that women softball players, women athletes are gay. This stereotype essentially comes from the kind of social mores around the masculine nature of sport and the fear of female sexuality and the fear that women will not be able to like live up to their reproductive potential. This comes in the early 20th century in the Victorian era when we really see sport begin to be popularized and when there's this like crisis of masculinity. And so sport becomes a place for men to be able to like perform this kind of masculinity. The initial criticism of women in sport weren't necessarily tied to homosexuality, but like a different kind of sexual deviance, like this idea that women athletes would be too empowered sexually because sport was tied to an inherent maleness and masculine qualities like aggression and competition because of these very strict Victorian gender dichotomies and gender roles.
We keep coming back every so often in this podcasts are just like, man, fuck the Victorians. Fuck you so much.
That's where this comes from. And so yep. Female athletes became symbols of the broader march of womanhood out of the Victorian domestic sphere into once prohibited male realms, representing both the appealing and threatening aspects of modern womanhood.
Yeah, and that comes from a scholar, Susan K. Kahn, in an article that she did, but she's also the author of a full book on women playing sport and the intersections of queerness. I think it's, what is it, Coming On Strong?
Coming On Strong.
Yeah.
And the controversy really fell into two main buckets. There was this fear about the effect on a woman's reproductive capacity. They thought sports would interfere with menstruation or cause women's uteruses to dry up or
fall out.
Yeah, because of the physical demands of sport, they thought that that was a possibility. And they were afraid of the unleashing of heterosexual passion, which is hilarious to me. These, you know, the women's locker rooms really, really bastions of heterosexuality. But basically, they were worried that sport would make women too horny or hysterical.
There's this quote from Kahn that I had to put in here because it just paints such a beautiful picture. She writes, "They feared the excitement of sport would cause women to lose control, conjuring up images of frenzied, distraught co-eds on the verge of moral, physical, and emotional breakdown. Experts vehemently debated whether competition unleashed non-procreative, erotic desires identified with male sexuality in unrespectable women." I really love the image of frenzied, distraught co-eds. It just paints such a beautiful picture. On the flip side, though, like, there were many that supported female athleticism and were like, yes, this heterosexual attractiveness of these women playing ball. And they actually, like, put forth the ideal of, like, athlete as beauty queen. And some games even included, like, beauty pageants. That was a whole part of it. On both sides of the debate, though, all that controversy around female sexuality and sport were operating in this starting point of presuming heterosexual deviant womanhood, which I think was one of the most interesting things for me to come up against in the beginning of this. They weren't concerned with, like, athletics inducing same-sex attraction in these women, but rather linked the physical release of sport with a loss of heterosexual control, not of inclination, as Kahn says. Which leads us to a word of the week.
Word of the
So, word of the week, this episode, we are talking about a phrase called muscle mall. One of the most frequently used derogatory term for women athletes by sports writers at this time was this term muscle mall. It had explicitly heterosexual connotations, but it always pointed towards some sort of deviant or disreputable womanhood, which, as we'll learn in a little bit, gets kind of implicitly tied to mannishness, which then evolves into lesbianism. It actually comes from just mall or gun mall, which initially referred to girlfriends of, like, gangsters, like mob gangsters in the 1920s. And it was also used as a euphemism for sex workers. In the US, it was more common to use it for, like, the gangsters side of things. So you usually saw, like, gun mall. And then in Australia and New Zealand, it kind of evolved with that, you know, sex worker connotation. Mall comes from Molly, which was used as a euphemism for sex workers as early as, like, 1600s. So, you know, we're building on this, like, long trajectory of the wrong way to be a woman, quote unquote, which of course then evolves into, being gay is the wrong way to be a woman and perform womanhood. Some examples that I pulled of sports writers using it. In 1939, there was a Washington Times article called Farewell to Sport, which talked about, the inclusion of women in sports. And they refer to this person who was a track star and then left the limelight and then came back as a golfer in the 50s. Her name is Babe Didrikson. And this quote has, "She was the muscle mall to end all muscle malls, the complete girl athlete. She was a tomboy who never wore makeup, who shingled her hair until it was as short as a boy's and never bothered to comb it, who didn't care about clothes. She had a boy's body and looked her best in a track suit. She hated women and loved to beat them. She was not, at that time, pretty. I always thought she became the greatest all-around athlete in the country simply because she was not or could not compete with women at their own and best game, man snatching." So, That gives you a good vibe of what we're dealing with. She sounds amazing. You have in 1956 in the Evening Star, Canada's pretty Jackie McDonald could be an Olympic champ, but she'd rather be a lady than a muscle mall. So this dichotomy really being upheld. And, you know, it evolves, right? So, like, mall became mole, M-O-L-E, which just kind of generally became slang for unpleasant or unlikable women. In the 70s through the 1990s, it basically just kind of supplants, like, bitch in Australia. So, yeah, that's a little bit of language history.
Word of the week. Gay word of history.
By the late 1920s and early 1930s, these mannish accusations from journalists really shifted from too sexual to unattractive, failed heterosexuals, as Susan Kahn puts it. The medicalization of homosexuality and the anti-feminist backlash had created this growing awareness of lesbianism and its connection with, you know, sexual deviance, as it was termed. So the evolution of the taboo and suspicion of the female athlete, that's where you start to see these associations pop up in the media.
And then by the 1940s, 1950s, you have, like, World War II's impacts on ideas around gender and sexuality, and the emerging moral panic, purging of queer people from public life in the form of the Lavender Scare when we get the Cold War. That basically just leads to everything solidifying, right? It leads to these accusations of mannishness leading to lesbianism growing and becoming more explicit. Kahn says, "Lesbians remained shadowy figures to most Americans, but women athletes, noted for their masculine bodies, interests, and attributes, were visible representatives of the gender inversion often associated with homosexuality." By the 1950s, you get this very, very ingrained stereotype established, and it could only be shrugged off by, like, proof of heterosexual success. So back to, like, Babe Didrikson, her career basically shows this shift really well. You know, in the 1930s, you have press writing about her hatchet face, quote-unquote, or doorstop jaw, which caused her to quit track, and she left the limelight. And then she comes back in the, you know, late 40s, early 50s, after she's married a professional wrestler, and she comes back as a golfer. But the narrative really shifts because this time she's, like, suitably heterosexual. So we go from these articles that say muscle mall and hatchet face and she's got a boy's body and she hates women to things like, you know, headlines like Babe is a lady now. The world's most amazing athlete has learned to wear nylons and cook for her huge husband. Or along came a great big He-Man wrestler, and the babe forgot all her man-hating chatter. It's the lesbian until proven straight, I guess, and then suddenly you know, are able to be perceived in a more serious way.
Yeah, even all you need is the right man to tame you.
Exactly, yeah. But how much is this, like, mannish lesbian, a homophobic boogeyman, versus actually a strong actual presence of lesbians in sport?
Right. Like, when we talk about lesbians in sport, it's like you don't want to uphold stereotypes, but at the same time, it is a stereotype for a reason. There do tend to be a lot of lesbians playing women's sports. And women's sports really become a site of queer community, right? We know, based on testimonials from players, that sport really does serve as a gathering place. It's a safe place. It's a place for people to find each other, you know, like bars were. And often they're safer than bars are because, you know, bars can be targeted in a way that the sports leagues really weren't. You know, Kahn says that these leagues provided space for lesbian sociability without naming it as such or excluding women who were not lesbians.
Yeah. So it doesn't put as much of a target on your back as, like, I'm in a lesbian bar and therefore I've got this marker on me, as opposed to, well, I'm just in this league and look, there are people who aren't gay here.
Yeah. And I mean, like, gay people, right, like, throughout history are really, really good at creating safe places in a world that's really hostile to them. And sports leagues and sports teams really are one place where that happens. Phyllis Irwin, whose partner June played on a women's company softball team in the 40s and 50s, wrote that, "Where else but at the games could we gather in public at a time when gay bars could be raided and you could lose your job if you got caught in a raid?"
I think that says so much of it.
Yeah. The stakes are so high. And then another, we have another player named Anne McGuire. She was a PE major, which many, many of these women were.
You'll notice a pattern.
You will. Also an amateur bowler in the 1950s. She said, I had been trying to figure out who I was and I couldn't put a name to it. I mean, it was very no gay groups, no literature, no characters on Dynasty. I mean, there was just nothing at the time. And trying to put a name on it, I went to a bowling tournament, met two women there, and for some reason something clicked, and it clicked in a way that I was not totally aware of.
I love that. Yeah, there's this quote from baseball player Nora Ross. She says that her time, you know, playing softball or baseball was, it was my first exposure to gay people. I was pursued by the one I was rooming with. That's how I found out. And then she proceeded to get involved with her roommate and lived a, quote, gay lifestyle the whole time she played.
We love a lesbian until graduation.
Right, exactly. Exactly. It was like, A, way to U-Haul, Nora, right? Like, like, oh, you start dating your roommate. Way to be a stereotype. And then, yeah, literally just like lesbian until graduation. It's so good. And also just like as a bonus, it was easy to meet women, too. Player Lorraine Summer from the league said, well, it was very nice because, you see, you developed your friendships. You didn't have to go out looking for women. They were all right there. You've got a built-in dating network right there.
Like the WNBA.
Yeah, absolutely. Or women's soccer, whatever. Most of all, though, like, sports essentially gave these women somewhat of a cover to avoid suspicions. In this athletic setting, these qualities that would have been, like, red flags for queer deviance were thought of as just part of sport culture. They were positive. Aggression and competitiveness and muscles, all of those things were like, well, yeah, but you need those to succeed in what we're doing. And Kahn says it permitted lesbians to express the full range of their gendered sensibilities while sidestepping the stigma of psychological deviance. Jojo D'Angelo, who was one of the players for the league, called athletics a comforting and comfortable place that just kind of allowed these things to happen. It was also a place for opportunities for unmarried women. And that's something that we kind of see coming up. You know, we talked about this, about queer women going into convents or going to sea. These are places that are complementary to queer life. That same player that we talked about earlier, Lorraine Summer, said, back then you either had to go into the convent or you had to get married, and that was about it. Nobody ever thought that there was anything else for women back then. So it was, thank God we had the sports. This is just an opportunity for women to get access to things that they would not have had inroads to before. At the same time, everything had to be hush-hush. You have this quote-unquote safe space, but you have to do it extremely closeted. Lorraine Summer, again, she says, you knew right darn well that this one was going with that one, but yet it just wasn't a topic of conversation. Never. So there's a real big emphasis on coding through dress and behavior, right? We go back to that butch femme dynamic, is like people are coding based on their dress and signaling, hey, I'm part of this community. And this flying under the radar could also have allowed for a more like gray space for women who maybe didn't like identify as lesbian, but they're in a place now that they can explore, right? So you don't have the same kind of commitment or target on your back as like going into a lesbian bar, as you know, for women who are just like exploring their identity. So let's talk about how, surprise surprise, there were actually a whole bunch of gaymos in the All-American.
There really were a lot of lesbians in this league, and what I found really surprising when I started to research this was that even of the players who are still alive, which there aren't, you know, many, but there are some, they still won't really talk about this. When I was writing my piece, I tried really hard to get some of them to talk to me, and it's just not spoken about. Most of them, if they are queer, are not out, at least not publicly, not going to speak about it publicly. Part of that is because these women were, as A.J. Richards says, indoctrinated into a culture of sport that denied a lesbian presence. They're also women of a time of war, when to be deviant was to be without rights, possibly to be hunted down, investigated, and publicly shamed. And so even though many of these players have avoided speaking candidly about their sexuality, there's plenty of evidence from stories and statistics and obituaries and lots of coded language. As we know, queers love some subtext. Mm-hmm. We love ourselves some subtext.
After all, if you rearrange the letters in subtext, you get butt sex.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That was one of my favorite jokes to tell in my early days of reading slash fanfiction. Yeah, if you rearrange the letters in subtext, you get butt sex, so.
Now I know.
There you go. That's where my brain goes.
But there was like a huge effort really to tamp down on all of this. So we know this, right? All of this conduct is in place and league officials enforced those rules incredibly strictly. They were punished players who were found in same-sex relationships or even players who had the appearance of being a lesbian. And that was incredibly subjective of like what we meant by appearance of being a lesbian. So some examples of this are Connie Wisniewski, a five-time All-Star. She played from 1944 to 1952. She was given a warning that she would be cut from the league if she got a bob haircut, which I guess was considered masculine. A player named Dottie Ferguson, who played from 1945 to 1954, was warned by a team chaperone against wearing Oxford shoes because they were too masculine looking. So Oxford shoes and bob haircuts are both a no. We had JoJo D'Angelo, who we've heard from already. She actually was kicked out of the league due to what they called a butchy haircut, which was just a bob. So she did get kicked out of the league for a bob haircut. And for some of the players, the league really was their first introduction to queer women. As we mentioned, a lot of them are from rural areas. They're from small towns. They didn't have a lot of exposure before this. First base Kenosha and Racine player who then became a chaperone. Her name was Dottie Hunter. She said she had never heard of lesbianism and her teammates sat her down and told her everything about lesbian life.
About the life.
The life. She said, they told me they had wedding ceremonies. I thought they were giving me the gears because I was a green Canadian.
Yeah. She apparently, like, when she went back home to Winnipeg, Canada in between seasons, she, like, went to her mom and she was like, why didn't you ever tell me that these things existed? And her mom apparently was just like, well, I thought you knew. And then Dottie's, you know, responds like, well, thanks for nothing. Or like, well, yeah, well, thanks for that.
Yeah.
She's apparently
she
like,
does now.
Why didn't you tell me that all of this is happening in the world?
Why didn't you tell me that this was an option? Seems dope. But right, there really is a risk to, even though they were all dating their teammates, there was still a risk to dating the teammates. So as much as we talk about this being a safe place, the league itself was safe until it wasn't. One All-American Girls League manager released two players who he suspected of being lesbians because he was worried that they were going to contaminate the team. So now we have that the queer contagion trope coming in. And because there was that very strict anti-fraternization policy, they would move players, trade players to different teams as a way to break up suspected romances. Sometimes they would switch the rooming situations just to see players' reactions as confirmation of a suspected relationship.
So we've talked a lot about the All-American, and everybody kind of knows about it because of movies and TV show. But really interesting thing that we came up against in our research is that this was not the only professional girls baseball / softball league during that time. This was not your only option if you were a woman in the 1940s who wanted to play professional ball, which makes all of these code of conduct rules really stand out as what they're trying to do to tamp down queer association.
The National Girls Baseball League was your other option. It formed in Chicago in 1944 because of the success of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. It was a pro underhand fast pitch softball league, but they promoted it as baseball, and it was strictly Chicago based.
So it's fun. It's the National Girls Baseball League, which is neither national nor baseball. It's fun. Marketing!
It was started by Forest Park Roofing Company owner Emery Parisi and the owner of the Chicago Cardinals football team, Charles Bidwell. Parisi owned the Metropolitan Softball League and decided to turn it pro after seeing the recruitment success of the All-American Girls League. They had six teams, the Bloomer Girls, the Bluebirds, the Chicks, the Queens, and the Cardinals, who became...
I think it's the Checkashers?
The Checkashers.
It's a very weird name. Yeah.
And the Music Mates. Can we discuss
the
these
Admiral?
Mates?
They were the Admiral Music Mates, and all of these were like the Parishi Gloomer Girls, Parishi's Admiral Music Maids. So still hearkening on delicate lady ball players, you know, in the name.
Yes. The chicks, there were chicks in the yep. All-American Girls League, yep. But yeah, the queens, the girls, the birds. How many slang terms for women can we find? Right.
And where the All-American focused on image and femininity, the National League was more focused on the sport. So while they're still like engaging in these like trappings of depicting women ballplayers in a certain way, they were not nearly as concerned as upholding that in lieu of prioritizing the athleticism and the sport. The National Girls Baseball League players were allowed to play in jerseys and shorts, and they didn't have to contend with things like chaperones or charm school or a crazy code of conduct. They were very loosey-goosey on certain things, like wearing shoes. They had a famously shoeless player. Lois Roberts would play outfield barefoot. Like, there's just these great pictures of her, like, jumping up, and she has no shoes on. I can't imagine that's super comfortable, but you do you, girl. It wasn't exactly, like, a lesbian utopia, though. You know, where the All-American was very tamping it down and all of this coded language and this code of conduct and couching it in femininity, apparently the Chicago League was more direct in denouncing same-sex activity. There's a line in an article that we read that said that they explicitly warned players about pairing off. So it was easier to kind of live in terms of expression than it was in the league, but also it was very much like, okay, but if we're going to let you do this, you can't be making out with your team players. They also welcomed and recruited players specifically who were either not invited or were excluded from the All-American League because they didn't fit the quote-unquote type, whether that was by the cishet beauty femininity standards or by racial standards. One player that continually kind of came up is Freda Savannah and her sister, who was known as one of the greatest softball players of her generation. And she was ignored, essentially, by the All-American. She was white, but she wasn't the, like, conventionally beautiful type that the All-American was playing for. I think she and her sister are of Greek ancestry, so they had a little bit of that, like, ethnic white, you know, kind of thing going for them. And the National League actually integrated, where All-American failed to do so, even after the major leagues did. So in 1951 and 1952, they have Betty Chapman, who was the first Black woman to play pro softball, and she played outfield for Admiral Music Maids. In 1953, they had Nancy Ito, who was a shortstop for the Bloomer Girls, and she was the first Japanese-American player in the league. And then in 1947, they had Gwen Wong, who was a lefty rookie pitcher for the Bloomer Girls and was second-generation Chinese-American. You have three Black women who played for the Negro Leagues as well on men's teams. They were the, I think, first and only women to play on the Negro Leagues. There's a documentary filmmaker named Adam Chu, who's been trying to put together a documentary on the National League for several years, and he says, "To me, the NGBL was more progressive, more diverse than the All-American League." And apparently they frequently, like, poached players from each other. So much so that they had to, like, strike a formal no-raiding agreement in 1946. But the National League, like, offered competitive higher salaries than the All-American, which for many of these women, what they were being paid for playing baseball was the most that they'd ever been paid in their life. And what they would have made in any other job. And they were focused on closer road games. So they were like trying to do, you know, saying, hey, we're more attractive because of these things. And so that naturally gave some of these All-American players some negotiating power. And so you actually see that many of these players ended up switching over to the National League after their time in the All-American. Some of them wanted higher salaries and less restrictions. Others wanted to, like, return to underhand pitching after the All-American had made the switch to overhand. It's really interesting to see the dichotomy between these two organizations and how they were advertising and emphasizing women playing ball.
But both of them were homophobic.
Yay!
That's what they had in common.
We've talked about some general, like, queerness in the league, and even though a lot of these women have not talked explicitly about themselves or were like, yeah, there were lesbians in the League. We knew how to spot them, but I'm not gay, though. We do have some either confirmed or coded language in obituaries and stories that have been told. So we wanted to highlight some specific players.
When I was writing my article for Narratively that we've referenced, I really wondered how I could find who the queer players were. And it dawned on me to search obituaries. And so I did. And we found a lot of longtime loving companions left behind. And so these are just some of the players. Some of them we found through searching obituaries. And some, like our first, Maybelle Blair, has come out. Maybelle Blair was born January 16th, 1927 in Inglewood, California. She is still alive and kicking. She was a pitcher. She played just one game in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League in 1948 for the Peoria Red Wings. And then she, like many players, moved to the National Girls Baseball League to play for the Cardinals. I love, by the way, that she played one game and has made, like, her entire, like, the end of her life just completely dedicated to this league.
Because she was there for a season, but she only ever played on the field publicly, like, in one game, right? She only actually was, like, called to the mound and pitched one game. So she had a lot of experience, but...
Yeah, she's rumored to be who Madonna's character of All the Way May is based on in the film. And she consulted on the A League of Their Own television series. She came out while talking to the writers, but she came out publicly during the press tour saying, I hid for 75, 85 years, and this is basically the first time I've ever come out. I said to myself, you know, Maybelle, at 95, maybe it won't be so bad. Maybe your family won't disown you. You've got to do it.
It just breaks my heart.
I will say, when I was working on my story, I sat down with Maybelle. I was at a women's baseball camp where she was this like special guest for the week. And I asked her about this and she wouldn't talk to me about it, not about anyone else in the league and definitely not herself. And I happened to know that she was gay. I didn't tell her that I knew that.
You could just clock it.
And she did not want to tell me. So I was really, really thrilled for her when she finally came out. She said that she first started to become aware of her sexuality in fifth grade. And her first love came when she was a senior in high school. She told the New York Times that she'll never forget her first love.
Oh, God, so cute.
She never got married and she kept all of her relationships private as an adult.
You also said that like she was just... super out there about like flirting with every single man that she came across.
Yes, Maybelle Blair's entire personality is flirting with men. She really leans into the All the Way May stereotype. But yeah, she really does lean into that stereotype of the like, you know, the man eater, the flirt.
Well, you know, if there's going to be a stereotype of a woman ball player, why not go for the safer, heterosexually deviant woman as opposed to the mannishly lesbian deviant woman? There
yes,
you go.
Yes.
It's the whore Madonna complex. It's the whore lesbian complex.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She said, I was so worried about my family because in those days, nobody knew anything about people being gay or what have you. It was so nerve-wracking. But when she got to the league, she said she discovered that there were more people like her, and it gave her and many of the other players more freedom. She said that during off days, the players would frequently meet up in Chicago and go to gay bars together, as we saw in the show.
Yeah, I think she said that like they just spent many of their weekends dancing.
She estimates that out of 650 players, she guesses about 400 were gay.
I love it.
Yeah, so that should give you an idea. But outside the league, people were much less accepting. So after she retired, she ended up having a 37-year career at the Northrop Corporation, which is now known as Northrop Grumman. She became the third female engineer in the company.
Hell yeah.
And she had a really high security clearance when she was working on B-2 bomber. But she said that that level of responsibility and access also came with a lot of scrutiny. She said that people would go around asking your neighbors about you. It's very nerve-wracking. Every time I moved, I was afraid somebody would discover that I was gay. And if they did, I would be fired right on the spot.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, well, and that tracks with right when the Cold War and the Lavender Scare are happening, too, where it was really explicitly like, well, we can't have any gays in our company and we're purging all of these people, especially in military and federal government and defense arenas, which she was in. So,
yeah, I imagine that it must have been really jarring to be, even though there were limits to the freedom in the All-American Girls League, to go from a place where at least there were other lesbians around you and it was like sort of a possibility and you could go to bars together and maybe you were getting like a whiff of some sort of freedom, and then the backlash of the Lavender Scare coming kind of like right after and everything getting, you know, conservatism taking hold. I assume that that must have been really like jarring and terrifying of an adjustment.
Yeah, like a rug being pulled out from under you. So next we have Josephine, or JoJo D'Angelo, who we've mentioned a couple of times. She was born in November 1924, and she was born in Chicago, Illinois. She died in 2013, and she was an outfielder for two seasons with the South Bend Blue Sox until she was kicked out of the league, as we mentioned before. She set an all-time record in the league for the fewest strikeouts in a single season, so she was like an incredibly accomplished player. And then she was kicked off the team for a butchy haircut that she said she never even wanted. It was one that she was pressured into getting by the hairstylist, who assured her she would look lovely with her dark curls trimmed into a bob. Which, it especially stings, because I think you said that you found that she really, out of all the players, was somebody who really, really tried actively to be closeted and not found out.
Yeah, she really wore an incredibly feminine style. She isolated herself from the players that were known to be gay to keep her sexuality a secret and to really try not to break these league rules so that she did not get kicked out.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're thinking about like a character analogous to this, like I would say that a lot of Greta's performance and experience in the TV show is really kind of harkening back to this survival strategy that players like D'Angelo employed of really trying to play up this performative heterosexuality and femininity for safety, which is why it's just so unfortunate that she was kicked out for something that wasn't even her choice and that she explicitly tried not to do. She, as you will notice, many of these women did, after she retired, she became a physical education teacher, and she had a 34-year career in the Chicago public school system until her retirement in 1980, and then she worked for 10 years as a guidance counselor. A lot of these women go into education, specifically physical education. She also played for the National Girls Baseball League. I can't remember which team that she played for. On her experience, like, as a lesbian in sports, she said once in an interview, "You brought your culture with you. You brought your arm swinging, the swagger, the way you tilted or cocked your head or whatever. First thing you did was to kind of imitate the boys because, you know, you're not supposed to throw like a girl." She referred to that safety of this rejection of femininity in sports environments, saying, "It was overlooked, see? You weren't different than the other kids. Same likeness. People of a kind." And she died in 2013 at the age of 88. Her obituary noted that she identified as a lesbian since her teenage years. And you put something in here that I thought was really cool about her funeral.
Yeah, guests received a picture from JoJo's baseball playing days that was made to look like a baseball card in lieu of a prayer card with a saint on it.
Oh my God. So did she never actually get a baseball card? Or was it just like they made this one like into a special one?
Yeah, I think it was made specifically for her funeral.
That's delightful. Aww.
And then we have Mildred Millie Deegan. Millie was born in Brooklyn on December of 1919, and she was an outstanding athlete from an early age. She came in second in the women's javelin throw at age 15, and she would have probably made the Olympics team, but she was too young. She played 10 seasons with the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League from 1943 to 1952. She started with the Rockford Peaches and also played on the Kenosha Comets, the Fort Wayne Daisies, and then she ended her career with the Peaches. Her prowess earned her the nickname the Babe Ruth of women's softball, and even Babe Ruth himself was impressed by her. She attended an exhibition game at Madison Square Garden, and she was rumored to have impressed Babe Ruth with her home run that went 260 feet. And there's a photo from the papers where he's squeezing the bicep on her arm.
It's so good. It is such a good photo. I love it so much.
Leo DeRocher, the Dodgers manager, told the Daily Oklahoma in 1946 that Deegan spent a whole week training with the Brooklyn Dodgers at their Bear Mountain, New York camp. If she were a man, she no doubt would have been a Dodger.
Yeah, I think there was a quote somewhere from some manager, not about Millie, but about another player that was like, I'd pay $50,000 for her if she were a boy. I was like, or you could just do that.
There's no rules in Major League Baseball that say women can't be drafted, so.
Yeah, well, there were also no specific rules in the All-American about black women, but.
Millie Deegan died of breast cancer in 2002 at the age of 82, and I found her obituary in the New York Times, which is where I found the name of her long-term partner, Margaret Nuss. She is labeled as Miss Deegan's companion and her only survivor. This is a contrast to a 1993 profile on Margaret, who was described as Deegan's cousin and roommate. Margaret Nuss, known as Toots. How do you say that?
I think it's probably Toots, but I kind of enjoy Toots.
Toots. She was also a softball legend. And according to the now defunct New Jersey Divas Fast Pitch website, Deegan and Nuss were partners for almost 50 years. They shared that passion for softball. Deegan was the coach for the Linden, New Jersey Arians, and Nuss managed the team. Margaret Nuss passed away just 6 months after Millie Deegan died at age 85.
Aw, their love kept them going together. All right, so next up we have Terry Donahue and also her partner, Pat Henschel. And this is probably, if you're going to look anything up about gay players in the All-American, Terry Donahue and her partner are who you're going to find, because there's probably more information on them out there than many of these other women. So Terry Donahue was born in Saskatchewan, Canada in 1925, and she was a catcher for the Peoria Red Wings from 1946 to 1949, and then she moved over to the National Baseball League and played for the Admiral Music Maids in 1950. She was scouted from a casual team in Moose Jaw at the age of 19, and she came to Chicago at the age of 20 in 1946. There's a wonderful little quote from her that during tryouts, she like slid and got a really deep cut on her eyebrow when she was trying to catch a ball, which needed stitches, but she told them, no, put a Band-Aid on it, I'm going out, I'm not finished. So, I mean, like, these women were just, like, really, I mean, just really going out there saying, nope, we're not gonna let anything get in our way. She met her partner, Pat Henschel, in 1947 when she was back home in Canada during an off-season. And Henschel was born in 1928, also in Saskatchewan, and she grew up on a farm. She never played softball, but she played hockey, and she worked as a phone operator. They met in 1947 during off-season at a hockey rink. And one night, apparently, Henschel wrote on the back of a hockey ticket and gave it to Terry. She wrote, I'm a reader of books, but I've never read anywhere where a woman loves another woman. I hope you feel the same way, too. So what a way to be like, I'm gay. Are you gay, too? I read gay books. Pat would basically travel from Canada to, you know, the various Midwest cities where the games were to watch Terry play. And they would meet in hotels. And I think they said that they met in churches for like private moments together. They would travel just like long distances to see each other for brief private moments. They thought that they were the only two people in the world like this, which is something that you see a lot of these women talk about during the time. They are so freaking sweet. Pat Henschel really loved to like write. She would do hikes and go up into the top of a mountain and like sit and write poetry. And they wrote letters and poems to each other. So you like find these letters and poems that their kind of family uncovered when they were all going through their things. And all of them have the bottom torn off. And that's because they actually, when they received the letters, they tore off the bottoms of the pages with their names on it in case somebody picked them up and found them out because they were so afraid of being caught out. And we have actually a couple of these like beautiful little poems that we wanted to call out here. All right. So these are written by Pat to Terry. So we have one that's always I'll remember this night. It might have been just one more walk beneath a moonlight hue, But darling, it meant everything, because I walked with you. It might have been just one more night, a single night of seven. My darling, you were there with me, 'twas one more night of heaven. On we sauntered, seldom speaking, as we passed through moonlit lanes. Happiness welled there inside me when you smiled and called my name. Hours flew like winged moments, hand in hand we walked alone. 'Twas one night I shall remember, one more night to call our own. Man, if I got one of these, I would marry that person.
Oh my god, I would dump them.
Oh, really? I don't. The difference between the two of us.
It's incredible. I'm an Aquarius Venus.
And, like, no, thank you.
Get it's basically me. Like no big romantic gestures. I love you, but like don't be cringe about it.
I'm so happy I'm making you read this then.
Yeah, you were like, can you read this? And I'm like, oh, sure. I did break up with someone once because they wrote a love song for me.
We're gonna force Frankie to like lean into the cringe.
All right. This one is called Our Best to You. Also written by Pat, I assume.
Yeah.
It's commonly known to one and all, your heart is set on playing ball. And since you're in with all the pros, I guess down south you'll have to go. Is that a euphemism?
I mean, that'd be great. Yeah, it's in quotes. I think it's, you know, it's going from Canada to the Midwest, but all right, also... Well.
'Twould be so nice to have you round, so though things won't be quite so gay, literally all summer long while you're away, here's hoping you'll set all the paces and break all records stealing bases.
It's very corny. It's
I'm sorry
very
about
corny.
My commentary. Hopefully
no,
it really lifted up the experience.
No, I love it. It's very corny. It's very corny. Adorable or cringe, depending on where you fall on the spectrum. Yeah, so like after Donahue left the league, they ended up moving into an apartment together in Chicago and had a small group of really close like gay friends and found family. They avoided bars for fear of being raided and found out. They were really explicitly like, no, we're never going to go to these places. So they usually met with friends in you know, their homes and had private gatherings. They worked together for the same Chicago interior design firm for years, and they hid their relationship from their work and their family until they were in their 80s. In interviews and articles about Terry Donahue, Henschel wasn't usually mentioned, or if she was, it was as Donahue's cousin or roommate. When their interior design firm was reported on, they were, you know, just business partners. They moved into assisted living together, and they actually got married on Donahue's 90th birthday at the facility in 2015, when same-sex marriage was legalized in the U.S. Donahue died in 2019 from Parkinson's complications at the age of 93. And Henschel is still around, still living in, I think, the assisted living facility, and likes to hang out, and she goes to, like, hockey games and, you know, does fun stuff like that.
Next, we have Dot Wilkinson, and Dot did not play for the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, but she is adjacent. She was born in 1921 in Phoenix, Arizona. She is still alive. She's 101 years old.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And she is one of the greatest women softball players of all time, as well as a bowling champion. She was inducted into both the National Softball Hall of Fame and the International Bowling Hall of Fame. So just like good at everything. She joined the Phoenix Ramblers, which was part of the Fast Pitch American Softball Association, as a bat girl in 1933 when she was 11 years old. And she played for the Ramblers for 32 years until 1965. During that time, she helped them to 3 national titles and doubled as the team manager.
Really is good at everything.
Good at everything. She has a record for the number of innings caught in one day. It is 47 innings. Can you imagine being a catcher and squatting and going, oh my gosh, for 47 innings?
My inner thighs hurt just thinking about that.
Yeah, my poor knees. So she was offered a contract to play in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League and turned it down. She did not want to deal with the rules. Sports Illustrated once called her a female Yogi Berra. She once followed a male heckler into a bathroom and beat the shit out of him with her softball glove.
Oh, one of my favorite things is like when she was inducted into the Arizona Hall of Fame. She did her speech, I think there's actually video of this, and she was booed by men in the audience because, you know, nothing has changed, I guess. And so she, you know, this is like at the end of her speech, she gets booed by these fucking men and she goes, thank you, now I feel at home. And then everybody just stands up and gives her a standing ovation. I just love that she's like, nope, fuck you. This is nothing new to me.
Yeah, she's used to it. There's a documentary about Dot. It's called Extra Innings, the real story behind The Bright Lights of Summer. And that was made by a filmmaker named Lynn Ames, who met Dot while making a TV show about lesbian women. And Lynn interviewed her and another former softball player. They wanted to pay me $85 a week to come play in this league, Wilkinson says in the documentary, and she's talking about the All-American League. But I didn't want to leave the Ramblers. I didn't care about the money. I just loved playing ball. And she was together with her partner, Estelle Ricky Cato, who was another softball player for 48 years. This is a real-life enemies-to-lovers trope. Cato was the second basewoman for the Ramblers' rival team, the Orange Lionettes, in California when they met. It was like this love-hate relationship. Ricky and Dot would just get into it on the field and fight and carry on. In one game, Wilkinson pissed Cato off as she slid into second base. And so when Wilkinson ran towards third later, Cato jumped on her back and made Dot carry her all the way to third base.
It's just like, it's real life enemies to lovers because they like...
It really is.
They like respect each other and also are just like complete rivals. And then they start dating in the 60s. Like, oh, I hate you. Oh, you're a constant thorn in my side. Also, can I kiss you maybe?
Yeah, they started... So, right, they started dating in the 60s and they flipped houses together. And referred to each other as roommates and real estate partners in public.
Why is that the gayest thing I've heard of this entire episode so far?
Why are there no house flipping shows with lesbians?
Why do we have
them?
To deal with the Property Brothers? Let's just do some two former softball playing lesbians together. Give me that TV show.
So Wilkinson said, we were born at a time when we were all in the closet and that was just the name of the game. And you have to live with it, and that's what we did. However, when Cato died in 2011 at age 85, Wilkinson made sure that their relationship was clear in the obituary. She said, I'd be damned if I was going to let that woman be buried and not have everybody know what she meant to me.
I love that so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually reached out to Lynn Ames while we were researching this episode, and she's got a book that'll be coming out in the fall, a whole biography of Dot Wilkinson and all about the Ramblers and women's softball. And so at some point in this year, I will be talking with her. We'll probably be bringing you an interview episode talking more about Dot Wilkinson. So stay tuned. I'm excited for that convo. Next up, we have Mabel Hall, who was born in 1920 and grew up in Jacksonville, Illinois. Her father was a semi-professional pitcher, and she grew up playing ball with her siblings. She played third base for the South Bend Blue Sox, and she attended the Mass tryout at Wrigley Field, and she became one of the original members of the league in 1943. So she started out for the Blue Sox, and then she was traded during that season to the Kenosha Comets. Her contract wasn't renewed in 1944, forcing her to try out again, which is so shitty, and she didn't make the cut. So that basically ended her All-American career, but hey, guess what? She moved over to the rival National, and she played as a Chicago Chick. After she left the leagues, she, surprise, surprise, became a physical education teacher, and she coached the high school teams. In her obituary in 2011, after she died at the age of 91, we have this sentence, Hall is survived by her longtime partner, Linda Hoffman. So, like Frankie was saying, a lot of times the only clue or evidence that we have into these women's identities and lives is by one line in their obituary, if they were out or brave enough to put that in writing. This list of women is not an extensive list at all. I mean, no. There were some that we were like talking about that we had read about and we're like, I don't know, this person kind of, you know, there's vibes, but we don't really have anything, so maybe we shouldn't include them.
But we have June Pepys, who was a pitcher and first baseman from Fort Wayne, Indiana, and she played in the league from 1948 to 1954. She was known as Lefty, and she apparently had some spunk. There's this story about her that the Fort Wayne Daisies manager told, and he told Lois Brown in her book, Girls of Summer. He said, once there were some men out in the street, and some smart aleck said something. I didn't hear what it was. They'd watched till I wasn't nearby. Anyway, all of a sudden I hear, wow. I turned around and saw that June Pepys had decked the guy. And I mean, she really decked him. He crawled away.
Man, she must have just punched his lights out.
Yeah, so we love June. And the league meant a lot to Pepys. She was the first chairperson of the Players Association board, and she was a two-time All-American Girls Professional Baseball League All-Star. And Polly Hewitt was her partner for 46 years before she passed in 2007, 9 years before Pepys died herself at the age of 86. And according to Pepys's obituary, they enjoyed golf and an active social life. Lots of golf, also PE teachers and golfing.
Yeah, PE teachers and golfing are the new lesbian-coded activities for these women. I have somebody that wasn't involved in either professional league, but I wanted to put in here, there's a woman named Lorraine Hurdle, who was born in February 1922 in Hunt County, Texas, and she didn't play professionally, but she was a black lesbian who played baseball and softball in the Women's Army Corps during World War II, and there's not a lot we know about her. Basically, everything that I got actually comes from my place of work. We have a collection on her, a very small collection that was donated by a friend. But she's a really, you know, an extraordinary woman, and we wanted to highlight a black lesbian who we knew played baseball. So she joined the military in 1944 at the age of 22 and was sent to serve in Germany. She never actually served, like, in the war. Everything was kind of winding down. Military records show that she re-enlisted after the war and stayed in the military until 1957. And she served as a clerk and supply specialist, a recruiter, and even a medical librarian and a surgical technician. She transferred back to the U.S. in the 1950s, where she had a very active social lesbian life. She loved cars and sports and gambling. Apparently, she had several Cadillacs throughout her life, and she named them all Princess.
Incredible.
Right? She was like one of six people in Army records who were listed as being authorized to travel back to Heidelberg, Germany to participate in the Women's Army Corps Conference Badminton Championships. And then we have like these several photos that we'll put up on the blog from her archival collection that show her with like a baseball or softball team in the WAC. We couldn't find more specific information about, like, what the team was, where they played, whether it was baseball or softball. You know, some of the pictures show baseballs, some of them show, you know, different sizes of softballs. But it was, you know, something that was important enough to her that in our very small collection, there are, like, 4 to 6 different photos of her with her team or hanging out or playing baseball. The military was super important to her. Her army friends were her chosen family, and many were also lesbians. So we talked a little bit up above that the military was also a place during this time where lesbians were finding community. And later in her life, amid her ailing health, apparently caregivers knew to, if she was being like difficult, not wanting to eat or shower or something like that, you know, when she was struggling with dementia, caregivers knew to salute her military style. And then she would just like, know, like, okay, now no business. I'm gonna do the things now. She applied to the civil service in 1957 and became an officer with the IRS. And then she moved to Berkeley in California in the 1960s and became an independent tax advisor. And she had a large group of friends and clients, and she primarily served the Black and queer communities with her business. The woman who donated her collection, Elizabeth Cornu, was really wonderful friends with her in the 60s and 70s. And she apparently liked to be called Hurdle. So she wasn't, you know, usually referred to as Lorraine. She was just called Hurdle. And she described herself as a rooster, or a super butch woman, or as Elizabeth Cornu described her, a classic old school butch. In the little biography that Cornu wrote about Hurdle, she said, "We spent many an afternoon at her apartment listening to stories about old time roosters and hens, butches and femmes. She instructed me regularly about proper femme etiquette," which is just delightful. When I was talking to Elizabeth, and I mentioned that, you know, a lot of these women we found in their obituaries, like, longtime loving companion, she said, Hurdle didn't so much have longtime loving companions as longtime crushes. She apparently had many frequent crushes on femmes, including at one point a Broadway entertainer or like go-go dancer. And she was apparently in love for many years with a Berkeley school bus driver called Miss Ruby, who apparently called Hurdle Daddy.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah, she did. Amazing. After several years of ailing health and struggles with alcohol and dementia, Hurdle passed away in her sleep in January of 2014 at her assisted living facility in Martinez, California. Cornu and her partner at the time, Darlene, interred her ashes at the Albany racetrack, which she said was one of her favorite places. I just love that this woman is like, yeah, booze, women, sports, cars, and gambling.
Yes.
It's fucking fantastic. Another we have very few pieces of information about just from her obituary is Barbara Sowers. She was born in May 1932 in Detroit, Michigan. She played during the 53-54 season for the Muskegon Belles and the Grand Rapids Chicks as an outfielder. And she, unsurprisingly, worked in public education and was a high school counselor. And her obituary noted that she was with her, quote, loving companion, Shirley Ann Weaver, for 45 years.
Norma Matrolis was born December 1925 in Lake Worth, Florida. And I actually know about her because somebody messaged me after seeing my story and told me that this was the sister of a family friend. She was described, Norma was described as a good defensive player, and she was nicknamed Trolley and had a total of only 14 errors in her five-year career. In that span, she played on five different teams from 1946 to 1950. After she retired, she went on to a career as an 18-wheeler truck driver. And according to her sister, she endured beatings, homophobic violence during her time, both in the league and as a driver. And all we know about her partner is that she had a longtime partner that she called her wife.
I mean, I just love that, like, just by virtue of, like, talking about this more, that a family member was, you know, felt comfortable enough to, like, come to you in, like, a message, like a Twitter DM or Instagram DM or something to say, hey, I actually know more about a player that there's just, like, nothing on.
Yeah, she sent me her baseball card and told me that at her wedding, Norma's sister came up and said, I wish my sister and her wife could have done something like this or could be here to see this.
Oh my gosh. That's so special. God, what an honor. Thank you to whomever this was that messaged Frankie and for allowing us the honor of being able to share a little bit of Norma's story here. Our very last person is Jean Cione or Cione. We weren't exactly sure how to pronounce her name. If anyone, you know, knew Jean, wants to, you know, write in, let us know. So she was one of the best pitchers to ever play in the All-American. She was from Rockford, Illinois, and she played 10 seasons in the league for four teams total. In that time, she threw three no-hitters, she had three 20-win seasons, and had an unassisted triple play. Something that's only, you were saying, has happened 15 times in Major League Baseball since 1909.
Yeah.
So
she was pretty good at baseball.
Just you know, just fine. Whatever.
She was all right.
She spent her rookie year in 1947 with the Rockford Peaches and finished with an astonishing 1.30 earned run average, which is really impressive. After the league ended, can you guess what she did? By context clues.
Was she a PE teacher?
Absolutely. She was a PE teacher with a master's degree. She actually became a PE teacher and became a professor of sports medicine. She coached women's basketball and track, and she became Eastern Michigan University's first director of women's athletics, which is super cool. Her partner, Ginny Hunt, told a newspaper, the Bozeman Daily Chronicle, after her death in 2010, that she was a lot of fun to be with. And she said, if you didn't ever experience watching a baseball game with her, you really missed something. It was a treat to watch a game with her. She analyzed every play. So all of these women, like, into their 80s, into their 90s, are still just so absolutely fired up about this game. It is in their blood. They have so much passion. You will see they're still doing reunions of the All-American now. And, like, you see these octogenarians and nonagenarians playing baseball. Like, it's... And playing baseball damn well. Like, they are still fucking rocking it. It's amazing. So, yeah. Those are our wonderful women of the great game of ball.
I'm sure there are many more. As Mabel Blair estimated.
Yeah, we just
have, like, three quarters of them.
Right, we just have to track down like 390 more.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we wanted to kind of end everything before we get to our How Gay Were They ratings with pop culture tie-in. We've referenced many throughout this episode, there's lots of places you can go to see different depictions of these women in these leagues. Obviously, we've got a league of their own, both the 1992 film by Penny Marshall and the 2022 Amazon Prime series co-written and produced by Abby Jacobson and Will Graham. The series goes far more into the queerness and also just queer life in that time, as well as goes into the lives of Black women ball players who were barred from the league in a way that the film was not able to accomplish in 1992. And actually, the film, I think, was inspired by a documentary, like a short little public television documentary made by a family member of a former player. And that's what inspired Penny Marshall to make the movie. We also have Extra Innings, the documentary by Lynn Ames. And you actually, Frankie, you said that you have it and you've seen it. I could not find it anywhere. I want to watch it.
I have it. I feel like I bought a DVD of it on Amazon when I was writing the Narratively story, but I do not know where it is. I have moved since then, and I wish I could tell you anything that I remembered about it, but I don't remember anything about it other than I own it.
Yeah. Check back in when I talk with Lynn Ames more. Maybe I'll be able to get a hold of it. And as I mentioned up above, we have Adam Chu, based out in Chicago, who is working on an upcoming documentary project called Their Turn at Bat, the story of the National Girls Baseball League. He's been working on it for years, and it's an independent project. Funding is super important for them to get. So, you know, if you want to kick some attention his way, if you want to learn more about it, you can support the project at nationalgirlsbaseballleague.com. They also have, I think, a Tumblr that'll be linked on the website. He's got a huge collection of really wonderful, like, memorabilia and pictures, and he's just been gathering all of this really cool information. And I was very sad when I was doing research to find that this was not already in a documentary in existence. So for my sake, do what you can to make sure that this thing sees the light of day, because I want to learn more about these people. And hopefully by that point, you know, more of the players will have come out and we can get explicitly queer stories from the National League. And then now it's a little bit of soapbox time.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we mentioned Terry Donahue and Pat Henschel, and that most people who have heard of any gay players in this league probably know of them. And that is because there was a documentary about them on Netflix that came out in 2020 called A Secret Love. And it tells the story of their relationship. It was made by Terry's family members. I believe her nephew.
Yeah.
I believe her nephew. And their story is really beautiful and wonderful. And I will say the documentary, they have so many photos and those love letters and poems that we, you know, talked about earlier. I think the caveat on that is it's very clearly told through the lens of, like, the straight family members. Mm-hmm. And I found that it lacked a lot of compassion for Pat.
Yeah.
And an understanding of their relationship. It really, like, you know, it follows this move to the assisted living facility, and you see Pat, who is a lot sharper and not as, you know, in need of that, those accommodations as Terry, is struggling with this decision to move and to leave the home that they've created, that they've lived in for like 70 years, where their chosen family is.
Yeah.
And instead of understanding that that might be hard, the family members are like, yeah, well, Pat took Terry away from us, and like Pat isolated her from us, and Pat, and I'm like, they went somewhere safe.
Yeah.
I don't.
I liked parts of it, but it was really frustrating that I can see why, like, the filmmaker focused it on, like, the family members and, you know, all of that, because they were experiencing this all together. But it really does suffer from a lack of, like, queer perspective. You know, they really only talk to other family members. They don't have talking head interviews with, like, any of their gay friends and family where they're living.
Yeah.
Which really just kind of disadvantaged an unbiased view of Pat and what Pat meant to Terry and what Pat meant to the family as well. You know, a lot of the people in the film say that they love and they like Pat because Terry loves and likes Pat, not the fact that Pat essentially acted as a surrogate parent for many of them for, you know, 70 years.
Pat loved and took care of their family member, and, like, yeah. It felt like a film made by straight people.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, that's the caveat is, like, I enjoyed getting to know more about their story. I enjoyed getting to know a little bit more about, you know, what it was like to be queer in the league. But just, you know, that kind of disclaimer on there is that, you know, you might, as a queer person, kind of find it a little bit frustrating at times. Well, we've reached our end. We're going to go into our How Gay Were They ratings. And this is a wonderful time for us to just do, like, kind of final takeaways, conclusions. Where does this leave us in the legacy of, like, queer women's sports, etc.? So, Frankie, we have a tradition on this show since I went solo of making our guest hosts go first in our ranking system by gently and lovingly hazing them. So, if you were to rate on a totally arbitrary number system made up of whatever markers you want, how gay was the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League and queer women's softball?
Ooh, I'm going 9 out of 10 because there were straight people there. So I'm not going to like give it a 10, but there weren't that many straight people there. Yeah. And also, I don't know, probably some of them did some gay stuff maybe while they were, we had the lesbian until graduation, right?
I think she probably continued afterwards. Let's be real. She missed it.
I mean, I can't imagine going back after going queer, but you know, who knows?
I know. We got to come up with like a nice rhyme of like, once you go queer, you
stay here.
Once you go queer, you stay here. There
you know
go.
What? But I don't want to participate in bisexual erasure.
True.
So
but that's still queer. That's still queer.
It is still queer.
It's not lesbian until graduation. She just, you know, discovered
maybe
her,
she's bi.
She discovered her latent bisexuality.
Yeah.
I will give it 11 out of 10 suggestively shaped hot dogs at a ballpark.
All right.
Because I feel like, you know, even though there are straight people in the league, I think just even the players that were not queer or were not confirmed queer or whatever were engaging in something that was just so inherently against the grain of expected gender roles, right? Like you have so many of these women talking about how they grew up being tomboys and just not being girly and not wanting to be interested in makeup, etc., etc. And they could have railed completely against that and said, but I'm not a lesbian or whatever. And instead, like, a lot of the times, it was just, for many of these women, it was just, like, not a non-issue. It was like, yeah, no, I mean, yeah, it existed in the league, and whatever, fine, sure.
It's true. I will say that I found that in, you know, my book on this football league, where it's probably a similar breakdown in terms of how many were gay. The thing that brought them together, like, many of the straight women did not care that their teammates were gay. They're doing this thing that the world tells them they shouldn't do. They're women doing something women aren't supposed to do together. They're up against the world together in this way. And so yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. I love the idea of these team sports as sites of entry for queer identity for women who were not able to take the step of walking into a gay bar. That underground queer sites is like so important. And it broke so many boundaries. It broke so many, you know, not to cliche, but broke so many glass ceilings, right? Like, I think you and I were talking off mic about how a lot of times people will just kind of dial really heavily into this very 2D explanation of like, and then Title IX happened and everything for women's sports changed, which there's like so much more complexity to it. And there's also, what do we make of these women who were playing at a time before that wasn't codified? And also, what has that done now?
Right. And I think when you don't look at leagues like this league or like the National Women's Football League or even like the WNBA, when you don't look at these leagues through a queer lens, right, and you try to take that away and just be like, we're going to focus on this sport, you're actually not getting a picture of what this league actually was and who was playing it. Because when you have a league that is majority lesbian, you actually have a league that is part of lesbian culture, right? This is now a lesbian cultural space, which means the locker room culture is going to be gay, right?
Yeah.
Which means that is what the league is it is predominantly queer, and therefore it is an important cultural piece, and you don't actually understand how the league fits in the cultural sphere at all, whether it's queer or otherwise, if you take the queerness away from it and you don't apply the lens.
Do you see another women's professional ball league happening in the future?
I feel like we're closer to a football league than we are to a baseball league.
Interesting.
But there is a national women's baseball team, which author Jennifer Ring calls the best kept secret in sports. People Ooh. Don't even know we have it. And so that does exist. But there's like no pipeline for women's baseball and really is not much organized women's baseball happening. We're seeing more of it at the girls level, but the pipeline and like infrastructure just isn't there right now for a professional league. I don't think anytime soon. I would love to be wrong about that.
Right. Well, and a lot of times too, like girls really get funneled into softball in a way that like people tend to associate softball as women's baseball, which is not true. Mm-hmm. And we saw in the beginning of this episode, like softball was just a different style of the game. And it was played equally by men and women and was outdrawing baseball at some points because it was just a different, faster paced game.
There's an organization called Baseball for All that does girls baseball tournaments, trying to create a space for girls to remain in the sport even after they maybe are being funneled towards softball in some regards. We just saw last week the first girl in history to play in a Division I baseball game.
Yeah.
That just happened last week. So, I mean, you're seeing that. You see individual girls breaking in. And you see more girls' teams at the youth level, but I think the infrastructure to get from there to a professional league just really isn't there yet.
Well, crossing fingers, hopefully in the future we will have another one and we will get the opportunity to interview a bunch of openly queer players. Let's make the future liberals want. Well, Frankie, thank you so very much for being here. This is like 3 years in the making and a beautiful friendship has blossomed. And I'm so excited to follow even more of your exploits and also just like learn more about you and all of your fun maximalist designing in your house. Could you tell everybody where they can find you on the World Wide Web?
Yeah, you can find me at TheFrankieDLC on Twitter, on Instagram. I am trying to figure out TikTok, so don't make too much fun of me, but I'm there too.
I'm a TikTok lurker. I've made exactly one TikTok, and it took me entirely way too long to do it, and I did it all for the sake of making a Xena meme.
Ooh, I started making TikTok content because I wanted to make Gaylor Swift content, so I'm right there with
you.
Oh,
yes. Also, Frankie is an avowed Gaylor fan, so, you know, if you want to talk about gay Taylor Swift shit, hit them up. Can you tell folks where they can find your book, and is there anything coming up that you are working on that people should look out for?
You can buy my book wherever books are sold, ideally your favorite indie bookstore. It's called Hail Mary. It is with me, and my co-author is named Lindsay Darkangelo. And I don't know, I'm working on a bunch of stuff. I've kind of took a break for a while from writing. I got a little burned out after my book came out, but I am starting to have some deadlines again. So I'd say just like stay tuned for stuff for the first time in a while.
And I think you said you were going to be possibly putting together a workshop on pitching articles, right?
Yeah, I'm hoping to run more regular workshops on like how to pitch writing and stuff, because it's a thing I do a lot. I'm okay at it. So I would like to teach other people how to be okay at it.
I'd say you're more than okay at it. I found you, didn't I?
You did.
Awesome. Well, I, as usual, am Lee Pfeffer. When I'm not nerding out about old-timey queer folks or reminiscing about my T-ball league days and how it made me into a giant homosexual, I'm usually talking about comics, queer TV, and other elements of queer history fun stuff at A Paradox in Flux on Twitter and also on Instagram, and usually crying about Xena episodes on my couch. History is Gay can be found on Tumblr at History is Gay Podcast, Twitter and Instagram at History is Gay Pod, and you can drop us a line with questions, suggestions, or just to say hi at historyisgaypodcast@gmail.com. If you enjoy the show and want to support us in continuing to make it, you can join our Patreon. As a patron, you can get access to our secret Discord server, Sappho Salon mini-episodes, where we will treat you to love letters and poems from queer historical faves. Maybe that's something that Frankie will not listen to because it's extra cringe. We also have pop culture tie-in live watches, and I am planning a future queer history trivia night to happen in the next couple of months, so stay tuned. We've also got exclusive merch and more. You could become a patron by going to the support section on our website or patreon.com/historyisgay and join the ranks of our patron community along with the amazing Lee, Bridget, and Jenna Magnuski. Thank you all so much for your support. We couldn't do this without you. You make things like reaching out to Frankie and saying, hey, would you like to do a cool episode with me possible? So I'm so happy that I have this lovely community of queermos keeping this podcast going for 5 years, which is insane for me to think about. You can also get merch on our store. You can just click on shop at our website. And lastly, remember to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. It helps more people find the show, and we can expand our awesome community. Frankie, thank you again so much for hanging out with me for like 2 hours and just talking about really gay stuff and reinvigorating my love of sports, which I had, you know, honestly kind of forgotten and then remembered how much I loved playing softball and t-ball and other sports when I was a kid. So I'm gonna go out and throw a ball around after this.
I love that.
Would you like to help me close out the show?
Sure.
All right. That's it for History is Gay. Until next time,
stay queer
and stay curious. ¶¶